So this fellow, there's this fellow whose name is Daniel Schroyer. He lives in Colfax, California.
We know him personally.
No, he doesn't live in Hawaii. And he wrote to me like about a month ago saying a friend of mine met you at Burning Man and said I should be in touch. So when I finally like sorted out all the story, it was someone who'd come by when we were giving out books and took one and gave him the email.
Sid.
And so I said, yeah, so send some poems.
Oh, okay.
And he did. And so he sent a whole bunch and I picked out a few and some of them are kind of nice. Okay. Listening to bombs. I'm not faithless and neither are they. Heroes, terrorists, who knows? Peace begins with forgiveness, not finding, but creating. Like mornings, each its own package, unwrapping, just born light, listen, the birds know. I name this epiphany unfolding, not so slowly, now that time knows me so intimately. I wish to share this opening, this understanding. Here are my hands, my heart, I am for mending. And this is, I am building. Listen, I am building a house of poetry, word by word, line by line, windows and doors, stairs both up and down, and long hallways leading everywhere. I haven't been yet or named. Listen to my hammering, how the verbs, who the nouns sound, every room a well-lighted place, your trust in language, it's how we think, how we pray. And God said, though I can't recall what it was, I have faith. His words, I am building a house of poetry and ain't no church or Bible, but God, how it means when you define your faith so personally. And this one is my just wildness. I immersed myself in the liquid hour before dawn, slowly awakening, not from sleep, but from the long, thin darkness where I had become feral by choice, laying down civilization an atrocity at a time, my just wildness a simplicity of shoes. Slowing destruction one step at a time. And finally, she spreads a red shadow. She spreads a red shadow, moves with the awkward grace of the left-handed, among her possessions, sun-bleached birds' bones, empty nests, dreams of flight, her faith designed upon the lesser gods. She speaks of war, but not the battlefields, how she learned the secrets of fear, how some men never recover, and why they could not sleep together. She woke, rose, lighted a votive candle, spreads a red shadow upon his cherished absence.
Okay, here's one I got for you.
Okay.
This is from my anthology. I saw this one when I was going through here and perusing this stuff, and immediately I thought of you when I ran across this one.
Sure.
It was a, oh God, where is this district from? This is from China. This guy, Lu Qi, from it says he existed from about 261 to 303 AD. And it's from a book of poetry, I guess, that he wrote that's called The Art of Writing. The pleasure of a writer knows, a pleasure a writer knows is the pleasure all sages enjoy. Out of non-being, being is born. Out of silence, the writer produces a song. In a single yard of silk, infinite space is found. Language is a deluge from one small corner of the heart. The net of images is cast wider and wider. Thoughts search more and more deeply. The writer spreads the fragrance of new flowers and abundance of sprouting buds. Laughing winds lift up the metaphor, clouds rise from the forest of writing brushes. And so there's a constance in poetry that resonate because it's what these people went through are the same things that we still go through, right? And this
Absolutely.
One is about bitching about your loud neighbors, right? It's anonymous from circa 1400. It's called The Blacksmiths. And I love the way that this reads out. Sooty, swarth smiths, smattered with smoke, drive me to death with the din of their dents. Such noise at night no man heard never. With knavish cries and clattering of knocks, those crooked cretins call out, "Coal! Coal!" and blow their bellows. That all their brains burst. Huff, puff, says one. half path the other. They spit and sprawl and spill many spells. They gnaw and gnash, they groan together and hold their heat with hard hammers. A bullhide are their broad aprons made. Their shanks are shackled for fiery flinders. Heavy hammers they have that are hard handled. Stark strokes they strike on steely stump. Lus, bus, las, das, rants the row, so doleful a dream that devil destroy it. The master lengthens little and labors less, twines a two and touches a tray. Tick-tack, tick-tack, ticket-tacket, tick-tack. Lus, bus, las, das, such lives they lead. These cobble mares, Christ give them grief. May none of these water burners by night have his rest. I love that term, water burners.
Water burners, yeah. Damn water burners.
Oh, and here's another one about what do you say? I think it's kind of saying that person who reads philosophy or poetry looking for a message but then doesn't live it. You know, sort of a hypocritical person.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really short one. This is from the Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
One who works and buys himself books is the title. One who works and buys himself books while his heart inside them is vain or corrupt resembles a cripple who draws on the wall 100 legs then can't get up. And this one, I remember, I found this one in a couple of books. This is an awesome one. And, you know, and again, you know, kind of resonates with stuff today because of the war that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
It's entitled First War. First War resembles a beautiful mouth which we all want to flirt with and believe. Later it's more a repulsive old whore whose collars are bitter and grieve. Yeah, it really says something, because everybody wants to, you know, it's like with the Cold War and everything, you know, everybody just kind of wants to go, oh yeah, well fuck you, dude, we'll bomb the shit out of you.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, yeah, fuck you, we're Americans. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're 8 years into some fucked up scenario and everybody's like,
Or like when the wars were, they used to march off in uniforms down Main Street. Everybody would cheer them as they, you know.
I liked this one. This was Chinese. And again, you know, it's like shit that it just, I don't know, kind of reflects how small we are in the scheme of things. And so what the proper thing to do is, mm-hmm. this is actually more modern.
Mm-hmm.
It's Chinese, from this character named Ho Chi Fang.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Get Drunk. Get drunk, get drunk. Those truly drunk are lucky, for paradise belongs to them. If alcohol, books, and lips that drip honey, if none of these can cover up man's suffering, if you proceed from being dead drunk to half sober, to fully awake finally, wouldn't you keep your hat cocked and your eyes half closed to act slightly intoxicated throughout your life? The flies, shivering in the cold wind, flutter their wings before the paper window pane, dreaming of dead bodies, of watermelon rinds in high summer, and of a dreamless void. In the epilogue of my ridicule, I hear my own shame. You, too, are only buzzing and buzzing like a fly. If I were a fly, I'd await the sound of a fly swatter smashing on my head. I love that, though. Get drunk, get drunk. Those truly drunk are lucky, for paradise belongs to them.
There is that moment.
In an
evening when you're having a good drunk. There's
unfortunately,
that moment.
It doesn't last.
It doesn't last, but there's that beautiful moment when you love everybody and all your enemies and struggles are as far away as they can be, you know.
Yeah.
And they're all beatable. They're all surmountable. You know. You'll
end up victorious. I love you, man.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, I remember many I love you, man nights. Enjoyed them greatly.
We have a friend in Israel, he lives in a kibbutz.
A kibbutz. I don't know. You mispronounce it so many ways I don't know anymore how to say it.
Kibbutz.
Kibbutz. Kibbutz.
Kibbutz. Kibbutz.
Anyway, her name is Jude.
Well, you know Jude from Spirit Plants, yeah.
So it's called Monday's Almost Into Evening. Starting to think about Tuesday and how I love Tuesday. Tuesday's a short working day. Tuesday brings forth the thought of 8:30 Tai Chi. Tuesday has a certain zen about it, a patience in the fragrance of miracle. How a shooting star could bring forth wishes, a rainbow, a pot of pot, a bicycle race for triplets, all Tuesday thoughts, and it's almost here. And this one's called Once I Stop Crying. I'll check the sky, I think it's still there. I hear planes and signs of life, a pack of geese waddling down Main Street, bicycle beware. Don't touch that dial, there. This ain't no Canada, this is dirt and tumble desert, watch it now, watch it.
Chapter 5, in which Piglet meets a heffalump. One day, when Christopher Robin and Winnie the Pooh and Piglet were all talking together, Christopher Robin finished a mouthful he was eating and said carelessly, "I saw a heffalump today, Piglet." "Well, what was it doing?" asked Piglet. "Just lumping along," said Christopher Robin. "I don't think it saw me." "I saw one once," said Piglet. "At least, I think I did," he said. "Only perhaps it wasn't." "So did I," said Pooh, wondering what a heffalump was like. "You don't often see them," said Christopher Robin carelessly. "Not now," said Piglet. "Oh. "Not at this time of year," said Pooh. Oh. Then they all talked about something else until it was time for Pooh and Piglet to go home together. At first, as they stumped along the path which edged the 100-acre wood, they didn't say much to each other. But when they came to the stream and had helped each other across the stepping stones and were able to walk side by side over the heather, they began to talk in a friendly way about this and that, and Piglet said, "If you see what I mean, Pooh," and Pooh said, "It's just what I think myself, Piglet," and Piglet said, "But on the other hand, Pooh, we must remember," and Pooh said, "Quite true, Piglet, although I had forgotten it for the moment." And then, just as they had come to the 6 pine trees, Pooh looked round and to see if nobody else was listening, and said in a very solemn voice, "Piglet, I have decided something."
"What have you decided, Pooh?"
"I have decided to catch a heffalump."
Oh my goodness.
Pooh nodded his head several times as he said this, and waited for Piglet to say, "How?" or, "Pooh, you couldn't," or something helpful of that sort, but Piglet said nothing. The fact was, Piglet was wishing that he had thought about it first. "I shall do it," said Pooh, after waiting a little longer, "by means of a trap."
"Ooh."
"And it shall be a cunning trap, so you will have to help me, Piglet."
"A cunning trap? Is it capitalized?"
Yes. Cunning trap. Cunning trap. "Pooh," said Piglet, feeling quite happy now, "I will." And then he said, "How shall we do it?" And Pooh said, "That's just it. How?" And then they sat down together to think it out. Pooh's first idea was that they should dig a very deep pit, and then the heffalump would come along and fall into the pit and... "Why?" said Piglet. "Why what?" said Pooh. "Why would he fall in?" Pooh rubbed his nose with his paw and said that the heffalump might be walking along, humming a little song and looking up at the sky, wondering if it would rain, so he wouldn't see a very deep pit until he was halfway down, when it would be too late. Piglet said that that was a very good trap, but supposing that it were raining already? Pooh rubbed his nose again and said that he hadn't thought of that. And then he brightened up and said that if it were raining already, the heffalump would be looking up at the sky wondering if it would clear up, so he wouldn't see the very deep pit until he was halfway down, when it would be too late.
Halfway down.
Piglet said that, now that this point had been explained, he thought that this was a cunning trap. Pooh was very proud when he heard this, and he felt that the heffalump was as good as caught already, but then there was just one thing that had to be thought about, and it was this. Where should they dig the very deep pit? Piglet said that the best place would be somewhere where a heffalump was, just before he fell into it, only about a foot farther on. Now, you see how this is reminding you about the current political situation? "But then he would see us digging it," said Pooh. "Not if he was looking at the sky."
Oh.
He would suspect, said Pooh, if he happened to look down. He thought for a long time, and then he added sadly, It isn't as easy as I thought. I suppose that's why heffalumps hardly ever get caught. That must be it, said Piglet. They sighed and got up, and when they had taken a few gorse prickles out of themselves and sat down again, and all the time Pooh was saying to himself, If only if I could think of something! For he felt that he felt sure that a very clever brain would catch a heffalump if only he knew the right way to go about it. Suppose, he said to Piglet, you wanted to catch me, how would you do it? Well, said Piglet, I should do it like this. I should make a trap, and I should put a jar of honey in the trap, and you would smell it, and you would go in after it, and I would go in after it, said Pooh excitedly, only very careful so not to hurt myself, and I would get the jar of honey, and I should lick around the edges first of all, pretending that there wasn't any more, you know, and then I would walk away and think about it a little, and then I should come back and start licking the middle of the jar, and then, well, yes, never mind about that. There you would be, and there I should catch you. Huh. Now, the first thing to think of, what do heffalumps like? I should think acorns, shouldn't you? Huh. We'll get a lot of, I say, wake up, Pooh! Pooh, who had gone into a happy dream, woke up with a start, and said that honey was a much more trappy thing than acorns. Piglet didn't think so, and they were just about to argue about it, when Piglet remembered that, if they put acorns in the trap, he would have to find the acorns, but if they put honey in, then Pooh would have to give up some of his own honey, so he said, All right, honey, then. Just as Pooh remembered it, too, and was going to say, All right, acorns. Yeah. Honey, said Piglet to himself in a thoughtful way, as if this is now settled, I'll dig the pit while you go and get the honey. Very well, said Pooh as he stumped off. As soon as he got home, he went to the larder, and he stood on a chair, and he took down a very large jar of honey from the top shelf. It had honey written on it, but just to make sure, he took the paper cover off and looked at it, and it looked just like honey. But you never can tell, said Pooh. I remember my uncle saying once that he had seen cheese just this color. So he put his tongue in and took a large lick. Yes, he said, it is. No doubt about that, and honey, I should say, right down to the bottom of the jar. Unless, of course, he said, somebody put cheese at the bottom of just for a joke. Perhaps I had better go a little further, just in case heffalumps don't like cheese, same as me. Ah, and he gave a deep sigh. I was right. It is honey, right the way down. Having made certain of this, he took the jar back to Piglet, and Piglet looked up from the bottom of the very deep pit, and said, Got it? And Pooh said, Yes, but it isn't quite a full jar. And he threw it down to Piglet, and Piglet said, No, it isn't. Is that all that you have got left? And Pooh said, Yes, because it was. So Piglet put the jar at the bottom of the pit and climbed out, and they went off home together. Well, good night, Pooh, said Piglet, when they had gotten to Pooh's house. And we'll meet at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning by the pine trees and see how many heffalumps we've got in our trap. Yeah. 6 o'clock, Piglet. Have you got any string? No. Why would you want some string? To lead them home with. Yeah. Oh, I think heffalumps come if you whistle. Yeah. Some do and some don't. You never can tell with heffalumps. Well, good night. Good night. And off Piglet trotted to his house, Trespassers W., while Pooh made his preparations for bed. Some hours later, just as the night was beginning to steal away, Pooh woke up suddenly with a sinking feeling. He had had this sinking feeling before, and he knew what it meant. He was hungry. So he went to the larder, and he stood on a chair and reached up to the top shelf and found nothing. That's funny, he thought. I know I had a jar of honey there. A full jar, full right up to the top, and it had honey written on it, so that I should know that it was honey. That's very funny. And then he began to wander up and down, wondering where it was, and murmuring a murmur to himself like this. It's very, very funny, 'cause I know I had some honey, 'cause it had a label on saying honey. A galoptious full-up pot, too, and I don't know where it's got to. No, I don't know where it's gone. Well, it's funny. He had murmured this to himself 3 times in a singing sort of way, when suddenly he remembered. He had put it in the cunning trap to catch the heffalump. Bother, said Pooh. It all comes back to the trying to be kind to heffalumps. And he got back to bed.
Trying to be kind by catching them. That's a very deep trap.
But he couldn't sleep. The more he tried to sleep, the more he couldn't. He tried counting sheep, which is sometimes a very good way of getting to sleep. And as that was no good, he tried counting heffalumps, and that was even worse, because every heffalump that he counted was making straight for a pot of Pooh's honey and eating it all. For some minutes he lay there miserable, but when 587th heffalump was licking its jaws and saying to itself, "Very good honey this, I don't know when I've tasted better," Pooh could bear it no longer. He jumped out of bed, and he ran on to the house, and he ran straight to the 6 pine trees. The sun was still in bed, but there was a lightness to the sky over the 100-acre wood which seemed to show that it was waking up and soon would be kicking off its clothes. In the half-light of the pine trees, the pine trees looked cold and lonely, and the very deep pit seemed deeper than it was, and Pooh's jar of honey at the bottom was something mysterious, a shape and no more. But as he got nearer to it, his nose told him that it was indeed honey, and his tongue came out and began to polish up his mouth ready for it. Bother, said Pooh, as he got his nose inside the jar, a heffalump has been eating it. And then he thought a little and said, oh no, I did, I forgot. Indeed, he had eaten most of it, but there was a little left at the very bottom of the jar, and he pushed his head right in and began to lick. By and by, Piglet woke up. As soon as he woke, he said to himself, oh, and then he said bravely, yes, and then, still more bravely, quite so. But he didn't feel very brave, for the word which was really jiggering around in his brain was heffalumps. What was a heffalump like? Was it fierce? Did it come when you whistled? And how did it come? Was it fond of pigs at all? If it was fond of pigs, did it make any difference what sort of pig? Supposing it was fierce with pigs, would it make any difference if the pig had a grandfather called Trespassers William? He didn't know the answer to any of these questions, and he was going to see his first heffalump in about an hour from now. Of course Pooh would be with him, and it would be much more friendly with two. But suppose heffalumps were very fierce with pigs and bears? Wouldn't it be better to pretend that he had a headache and couldn't go up to 6 pine trees this morning? But then suppose it was a very fine day and there was no heffalump in the trap. Here he would be in bed all morning, simply wasting his time for nothing. What should he do? And then he had a clever idea. He would go up very quietly to the 6 pine trees now, peep very cautiously into the trap, and see if there was a heffalump there. And if there was, he would go back to bed, and if there wasn't, he wouldn't. So off he went. At first he thought that there wouldn't be a heffalump in the trap, and then he thought that there would. And as he got nearer, he was sure there would be, because he could hear the heffalumping about it like anything. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, said Piglet to himself, and he wanted to run away. But somehow, having gotten so near, he felt that he must see what a heffalump was like. So he crept to the side of the trap and looked in. And all the time Winnie the Pooh had been trying to get the honey jar off his head. The more he shook it, the tighter it stuck. Bother, he said inside the jar, and oh help, and mostly ow! And he tried bumping it against things, but as he couldn't see what he was bumping it against, it didn't help him. And he tried to climb out of the trap, but as he couldn't see nothing but jar, and not much of that, he couldn't find his way. So at last he lifted up his head, jar and all, and made a loud roaring noise of sadness and despair. And it was at that moment that Piglet looked down. Help, help, cried Piglet. A heffalump, a horrible heffalump. And he scampered off as hard as he could, still crying out, help, help, a horrible hoffalump. Hoff, hoff, a hellable horrolump. Hol, hol, a hoffable hellorolump. And he didn't stop crying and scampering until he got to Christopher Robin's house. Whatever the matter, Piglet, said Christopher Robin, who was just getting up. Hef, said Piglet, breathing so hard he could hardly speak. A hell, a hef, a heffalump. Where? Up there, said Piglet, waving his paw. What did it look like? Like, It had the biggest head you ever saw, Christopher Robin. A great, enormous thing, like nothing. A huge, big, well, like, I don't know, like an enormous big nothing, like a jar. Well, said Christopher Robin, putting on his shoes, I shall go and look at it. Come on. Piglet wasn't afraid if he had Christopher Robin with him, so off they went. I can hear it, can't you? Said Piglet anxiously as they got near. I can hear something, said Christopher Robin. It was Pooh bumping his head against a tree root he had found. There, said Piglet, isn't it awful? And he held on tight to Christopher Robin's hand. Suddenly, Christopher Robin began to laugh, and he laughed, and he laughed, and he laughed. And while he was still laughing, crash went the heffalump's head against the tree root, smash went the jar, and out came Pooh's head again. Then Piglet saw what a foolish piglet he had been, and he was so ashamed of himself that he ran straight off home and went to bed with a headache. But Christopher Robin and Pooh went home to breakfast together. Oh, Bear, said Christopher Robin, how I do love you. So do I, said Pooh.
Good stuff.
Yeah. But that whole, it's so like the politicians. Well, how are we going to fix the economic crisis? Well, we'll just send everybody some money. That'll do
well,
it.
Well, the crisis is right here, so we'll set a trap.
Yeah.
We'll set the trap a foot away, and right. It'll fall in.
Because it's got to be looking up at the sky.
It's going to look at the sky whether it's raining.
Whether it's shining or if it's raining. It's just, because it's sound logic if you're an idiot.
Yeah. If you don't pay attention.
Right.
We had an article that was published in the Boston Phoenix about Harvard doing acid research.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the new research.
Yeah. And so we published that again in the Cynical because it was very interesting. And it was by somebody named Peter Biebergall.
Biebergall?
Lives
at Cambridge.
Yes. But he talks a lot about Halpern and
Doblin.
No. Doblin, yeah. Doblin. From Maps, right? And somebody named James Fadiman. And I'm just gonna read a little section. Of it. And this section is called The Three-Headed Beast. And maybe I'll just read the first paragraph, because it's interesting. Imagine you are standing before the gate of Hades, which is guarded by the three-headed dog Cerberus. But instead of ripping you to shreds, he offers you some choice acid in a detailed map of the underworld. The world of psychedelic drug use is not unlike this friendly, electric Kool-Aid doling version of the ultimate hellhound. The first head is that of the drug-adoring hippies who grow their own mushrooms and continue to nurture conspiracy theories about the drugs while they search for a mystical experience from them. The second belongs to the scientists, people like Halpern, Roland Griffiths, who led a study in psilocybin and mysticism at Johns Hopkins, and Rick Strassman, whose 1990 then-radical research into DMT, the powerful drug found in the psychedelic drink ayahuasca, favored by South American shamans, opened the door for legitimate psychedelic research, research done under very controlled and rigorous conditions. And the third head is a weird conglomeration of the other two, typical of such folks as Daniel Pinchbeck, who lauds the spiritual benefits of DMT and uses a kind of pseudoscience to chart the date of the apocalypse, all the while having serious and sober proclamations to issue about the environment and technology. But many times, particularly when tripping on some fine blotter acid, these heads merge into a single face. At the World Psychedelic Forum in Basel, Switzerland, this past March, those in attendance included Pinchbeck, the psychedelic artist Alex Gray, and a number of ethnobotanists, shamans, psychics, psychiatrists, and chemists, including Hoffman, to name a few. That all these individuals could unite under the umbrella of their interest in psychedelic drugs points to an underlying shared concern. Is there a future for psychedelics outside of fish concerts? And can this be achieved when, alongside those doing serious research, there are those who believe themselves to be reincarnations of Quetzalcoatl? Doblin thinks he has the solution. I meet with the founder and presidents of MAPS at his house in a quiet neighborhood in Belmont. Again,
which is a very nice neighborhood in Boston. Nice town.
Again, as was the case with Halpern, there is little to suggest that this is the home of a leading anti-prohibitionist and one of the most important figures in the story of psychedelic drug research. The house shows more signs of kids and dogs and happy family life than Doblin's work. I wonder if the neighbors know the guy next door mowing his lawn has probably taken more trips than a host of Logan-centric frequent flyers.
He tries very hard.
Yeah. Doblin's psychedelic story began in 1971 when he was 18 and wanted to become a psychedelic psychotherapist in the tradition of Stanislav Grof, who was the first to work with LSD as a therapeutic agent. But to Doblin, there was a problem. I was waking up as everything was being shut down. So he dropped out of college and worked as a carpenter, and at beginning, a seasoned LSD traveler. Oh, at becoming a seasoned LSD traveler, sorry.
Seasoned. What does that mean? Seasoned LSD traveler.
See, we have issues with this guy.
What does that mean? I've been wondering about that phrase every time I heard that.
10 years later, he went back to school, recognizing that if he was going to do anything involving psychedelic drugs that would be taken seriously, it would have to be above ground. In 1984, Doblin's work in psychedelic research was suddenly given a purpose. While use of MDMA was legal, it had not yet made its impact in the underground. The Federal Drug Enforcement Agency, DEA, suggested it was going to start the process of criminalization. Doblin gathered together a group of above-ground researchers under the name the Earth Metabolic Design Lab, ENDL, and they decided to sue the DEA. The board of advisors included practically everybody in the field of psychedelic research at the time, including Dr. Andrew Weil and Laura Huxley, widow of the late Aldous. By 1985, Doblin and his colleagues were making inroads, until, that is, Doblin was a guest on the Phil Donahue show. As the spokesperson for the EMDL, he explained that MDMA should be a Schedule III drug, only illegal without a prescription. Donahue asked him what he thought about other uses. I said I thought prohibition was a disaster and recreational use is a pejorative term, recalls Doblin. It caused a big problem and I was labeled the Tim Leary of the 80s. Some of the people in Doblin's group were government-funded and many threatened to resign from the EMDL if he kept speaking out publicly against drug prohibition. So I decided I would resign, said Doblin. Without Doblin's leadership, the group dissipated. By 1986, Doblin was even more convinced that his work needed to move from the counterculture to the mainstream, and so he founded MAPS. MAPS has helped support a number of projects, including FDA-approved marijuana studies and an LSD study in Switzerland. But Doblin still wanted to pursue his teenage dream of becoming a psychedelic therapist, helping people to move through trauma and other neuroses with the guided use of hallucinogens. If he is anything like Leary, he's Leary sans egotism and self-importance. Doblin applied to a number of PhD programs, but no one wanted to support a grad student who was looking to use psychedelics in psychotherapy. And what Doblin describes as a stoned insight, he realized that since politics kept getting in the way of the work he wanted to do, maybe he should study the politics. His application to Harvard's Kennedy School of Government was accepted, and in 2001 he received his PhD. Despite his Harvard affiliation, Doblin's reputation and MAPS's ties to the underground often remain a heavy burden. In 2002, Doblin wanted to do an MDMA study with Halpern, but he needed to demonstrate to McLean, who I believe was somebody in his lab funded him.
McLean's a hospital.
Oh, sorry. Well, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
That MAPS is not a cheerleader for the drug and is genuinely interested in risks as well as benefits. The methodological rigor of MAPS's research should all overwhelm the fact that I happen to believe that prohibition is a bad idea, says Doblin. Early MDMA tests focus on neurocognitive effects that deal with behavior and memory related to brain function. But Doblin believes these studies were flawed because most users of MDMA do other drugs, making it impossible to know if any cognitive deficits were a result of MDMA use alone. And as serendipitous as the cluster headache email was for Halpern, which he talks about earlier.
Yeah, LSD and cluster headaches.
Which is very interesting. Have you heard about that?
No, but I've heard some anecdotal stuff about LSD and the migraines.
Apparently, cluster headaches are way worse than migraines. It makes people think that they have the devil in their head.
Oh,
like, nice. It's like literally
Very, very painful.
Very, it's like the most painful type of headache you can have.
And so they, this disparate group of people suffering from this discovered that they all used LSD to...
And it was like the only thing they could find that, yeah, that relieved it. And so they came together, and I think Halpern just happened to stumble across this website and emailed them and said, can we do this research with you guys? Doblin received information from a MAPS member about a group of people who have done MDMA exclusively with almost no history of prior drug or alcohol use, young fallen Mormons in Utah.
No.
This was interesting. Doblin went to Halpern and Halpern's boss, Harrison Skip Pope, and proclaimed his objectivity. He says, I told them I'm fine with risk. I don't have to be defensive about this drug. Let's do the best study we can do. MAPS gave McLean $15,000 for a pilot study with the Mormons. Eventually, the National Institute on Drug Abuse gave McLean $1.8 million for further MDMA research. Million is capitalized. Apparently, it's million with a capital M. Hmm. It's an important
million. If I had a million, I'd use it with a capital M.
Probably so.
Especially $1.8 million. So it's more than
not
a million.
Not just one. Yeah. The next project that Doblin and Halpern wanted to launch was the MDMA cancer study. MAPS was getting money for Halpern's salary and other preliminary steps to get the psychedelic research off the ground, and then finally got permission from the FDA in 2004. In January 2006, however, McLean installed a new president, Dr. Jack Gorman, who had worked in the federal drug czar's office. Gorman looked at what McLean was about to sign off on, the first psychedelic study at Harvard since 1966, and stopped the project in its tracks. I knew this was important research, Doblin tells me. People are dying in pain and fear. But there was no way Gorman was going to greenlight a study involving Doblin, a known drug user and an anti-prohibitionist with a penchant for suing the government. So MAPS withdrew, explains Doblin, and instructed one of its major funders to donate directly to McLean. Still, Doblin didn't go that quietly. He was able to get permission to cross-reference whatever data comes out of the study, which he hopes to use for MAPS's own mission to get MDMA and hopefully other psychedelics made legal for therapeutic purposes. Gorman resigned his post in May 2006. So then it goes on to talk about the new studies that they're doing. So. But that was an interesting section about Doblin and MAPS.
All right. So here's some poems from the summer that I wrote in the summer. This first one was from Burning Man. I was up on the top of a temple made of trash. It was two floors. I was looking down on the city from up there and thinking, high on labyrinth, endless desert to go. Victor can speak to the setting of this next poem I'm going to read because he was there once. Victor, remember the... Remember the boarding house I lived in?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I remember that place.
Yeah.
You got pictures of it or something?
No. I wrote a poem about it.
Oh, okay.
So, and I was just saying to Cassie that Victor visited this place.
I can't wait to hear what you have to say about this place.
Yeah, you know, you get sentimental for. Various places you've lived.
Yeah, I'm sleeping on a table.
Yep. So, the poem's called Paucity. That dirtbag room in her lunatic house, where I sat by TV with a dish of warm, cheap food and a torrid, crumbling wish. Fate took its time, relaxed, silent by those many hours that I writhed. Amid my hard wants, savage musics bloomed. Whether yearned for a coupling or a coin, the din of days is the tapping of a heart's empty bowl for notice, for some token it can keep. Some pittance will survive its miles, swathe its light, swathe its nights, complete old promises of dear forgotten faces spoke roughly on autumn benches in far-gone parks.
God. Yeah, you kind of summed up that time.
Yeah. And this poem's called Rant. I was just pissed off.
You?
Yeah, I was just pissed off. I'm not always pissed off, but... amid this curtain savagery, the lies explained his loyalty, discarding the man to keep the idea. The hunger for orgasm even a full moon cannot sate, and art will not explain, and tradition the praising of today's shit because it smells like another's. How the spirit moves caged in a book read from a pulpit by a man who dreams of adding his cum to the flames burning down the heathen's village. Brave talk of God's love as a mystery, not a bondage. Brave talk of the world as gift and game enough for all. Brave talk of another in question and early morning curiosity. Tell me of a hope that does not rest dependent on another, or a despair that cannot be cut with a touch, a barking, hungry, persistent word of empathy. Love's long, blind reach into the dark.
Yeah, that's good.
I was at least ranting coherently.
Ranting coherently?
Yeah, doing my best. This one's called Many Moons. If a dream of many moons in the sky, what else then? What more than sitting in festive groups staring one another for the hour's favorite quip? What not men among the roots? What new stars among ceaseless lonely want to fertilize the world with more? Many moons in the sky, in dreams and otherwise, more than celestial formulas or a guru's solemn named day, else than the heated bestial grunts of age picking over youth's glinting bits, waiting the foothold more luring than a new lover's thoughtful recline among shadows. The first word of the song stars no better than men.
Stars?
The first word of the song stars no better than men. This one's called After Embrace. I watched them each part of life as he walked across the street and she hurried down the sidewalk. Neither looked back, as though that easy. And this one's called A Fable.
Read that one again.
That one? After Embrace? Mm-hmm. I watched them each part of life as he walked across the street and she hurried down the sidewalk. Neither looked back, as though that easy.
Yeah, boy, I've been there.
A Fable. A man smiled and leaned against another man, said, "This is my land, brother, but I'll hire you to work it for me." The second man heard his baby crying and checked his options, none, asked his pay. No freedom in working another man's land as he counts, nor freedom in striking him down. Freedom not found in a coin or a crown or a cross. Freedom's hour come when none above, none below.
There, I got one that's kind of like that. It's kind of a little different play, but it's on a similar idea. Except for it's written from the landowner's perspective.
Oh. A reply, as it were.
From Lao Sung Young, right? Mm. Uncovering the bones of Chang Chin, the hired man.
Covering or uncovering?
The covering.
Oh, the covering, okay.
The cycle of life is a worrisome thing, a single breath that gathers and scatters again. When we come by chance into the hubbub of joy and rage, and suddenly we take leave again. To be an underling is no disgrace. Neither is nobility divine. All at once, when breathing stops, fair and ugly disappear in decay. You slaved in my stables all of your life, cutting fodder. You never complained you were tired. When you died, we gave you a cheap coffin and buried you at the foot of the eastern hill. But then, alas, there came a raging flood that left you helter-skelter by the roadside. Dry and brittle, your 100 bones baked in the sun, scattered about, never to join again. Luckily, an attendant told me of this, and the vision saddens me to tears. For even cats and tigers rate a sacrificial offering, and dogs and horses have their ragged shrouds. Mm-hmm. Long I stand here mourning for your soul, and how could you know of this act? Basket and spade bear you to the grave, which waterways will keep from further harm. My mind is now at ease, whether you know it or not.
One should wait for spring to cover up bones, and propitious is the time now. Benevolence for all things is not mine to confer. Just call it a personal favor for you. So it's like, he's telling this horrible thing that happened to you, and it's also kind of a lesson. Don't bury bones in the flood district.
Right, right. Do it in springtime.
Yeah. Then you know where it floods.
Right, right, right. Yeah. So the next poem I wrote was for Cassie. I don't write love poems very often anymore. I used to write a lot of them. Maybe I just...
No, you're old and jaded.
Well, I decided to see what it would sound like to write a poem, a love song now, a purposeful, like... Because the year before I met Cassie, I wrote her a sequence. Not the year before I met you, the year before we married. Not the year before we met. I wrote a sequence anticipating you, imagining you. No. But anyway, so this poem's just called Love Song. What remains of the years I sing and call my art, what salves my suffering or sets it to a softer tune. The need to fuck, the need to piss, the breathing, the beating, the fury toward what beauty these autumnal hours. And love, I can only think, is how my music protects and calms your nights when I cannot do this for all. That's not much of a poem. Next one's called Downtown Lights. When the dead return in dreams, helpless, breathless, or the lost lover, never was a goodbye, a thank you, a shared nod, a failure. But there was my father taxiing me to kin, and here I was in the back seat complaining I'd forgotten my notebooks. And again was that lover left to me a dictionary marked with cryptic directions to reach her, reach back to her. He's a while dead in the ground, she's now even longer dead in my heart. Yet reckless hours, ink-spending slave to each, heart's deep bruises beating this music in me, squeezing me out as once his loins squeezed me out too, as once I cried and squeezed within her, till the heat ran cold, and earth drank piss and blood. This poem's for all the smart people. Sage, cry the truth and tend it. You're traveling away from its moment, now and still. Feel it drown on the shore. Feel each new hour huddle near, chew at it, its lake crackling apart. But what you knew, how sure, and tell, tell. None need suffer without explain again. Feel it going, even as you tell others among the oaks, even as you shape your speeches and songs. Going, every day. Wake up, it's going. Let it. It fed that hour, sated it, bloomed that hour with hope. Let it settle among the rest in your heart. Let it relax from truth to faith. Now a breath, maybe two. What's left, not sentiment, let abide. This one's called The Midnight Cry. To said the beasts beneath the bricks, waiting night or distraction or an elixir's flash of something hungry. To said the erotic coils tight and getting tighter, now what will make it burst? To said civilizations built tremblingly on ruins and bones, breathes and drinks with ghosts. 'Tis expected by many this world of men will fall to a bomb, some god's minions will, or rise to another god's return. It won't last, however, the end, at best a smiling recall to the stars, beauteous hour. We do not know universe. Our hunger, our flesh hungers for each other, for light, for music, for answers. We do not know. Our hopes cloak pretty on the beast's shoulder, our fears that the beast is all we really are. But I started thinking, well, so what if I was a hungry ghost? Like, what kind of hungry ghost would I be? I was just, you know, speculating. You know, you just look for material everywhere and you write poems. You just, whatever. You know, start looking at your fingernails.
You could have a lot of fun with this one.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So I was like, okay, so I call it Hereafter. I'll be the hungry ghost returned to snap at clusters of tight skirts, snap till I hear one who laughs and wants more, snap till she cries out, till she's urging the rest. Or the clustered thorn in the preacher's golden costume, now burbling, now biting, when he speaks smoothly of God's mystery and suffering, cramp his holy thighs when he lusts, when he loathes. When the king raises his fist smiling, would command not just armies of men and machines, but the woods, the tides, the moon itself, I'll blind him a moment, and give his tongue a heated taste of his own shit. When one man leans on another, measures the world's worth in coin and commodity, when he sharpens others to wreck him with quicking breath, I'll crumble his ankle and wither his cock. When the lusty crowd denses round a single helpless face, moves in with a noose or cuffs, I'll sweat each one with panic, choke, and tomorrow your door, tomorrow will be you. Lastly, the child, with her new breast blooming, with his questions shuffled toward thick books and stained glass, I will spend the last of me scrawling over young hearts, nobody knows all, believe, with every window open.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept, though, isn't it?
And I call the poem Stench of Duende. It was in that cash-only motel room, those furthest hours when I undressed you, as others had, love was fucking's residue, your young body long trained to be taken, to clash and lick sinews for hearts. It would hurt a little, but he would say it. And I sighed and held you lightly for all the devils and violence that led you blithely to my arms and would retrieve you again by morning. So this is the last quartet of poems I wrote last Saturday. I was working on deadline. I wanted to get 30 of these in here. So I was writing poems very fresh to, like, tonight, which was kind of challenging, but it was fun, too. Distraction. If a preacher's wily words of other worlds or a fine ass on an evening avenue distract, if the taste of meat or chocolate, if a snowy wind thrilling every tree in pathless woods, if the sight of a fallen creature on an empty road, broken and going yet blindly breathing on, if the stars weightless and some say portending, if the remembered laugh of a loved one known only in your earliest youth, if dreams drowning in sand and those when earth is impossibly viewed from above, if the preacher's blithe promise of today's answer, of someday's answer for today's kneel and obey, if the rest matches in soulful beauty that fine, fine ass, what then otherwise was the reason for arriving to this hour, you and I, the world blood-racked to blue, what was the reason? It's like a long rhetorical question. This one's called Breath Bewitching. What diminishes in some hours is not just the want to know, but the faith anything can be known. Answer not fruited of hustle or delusion. The questions asked the skies on worse nights, and those glints nearly touched on others, can some, manifest, fold the world at last gently open, and what seemed random horror of chance and limited view will reveal finally in music a mystery more beautiful because made plain.
Seems like you've changed up your writing style a little bit.
Think so?
Yeah.
Okay.
Seems more on a theme. You know what I'm saying? Some of the other stuff has been this kind of juxtaposing rough ideas, right? Mm-hmm. One idea, you know, kind of a image, flash of an image, and a flash of an image, and now it's kind of more like a painted picture. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Mm, that could be good. Song to a Stranger. Some other night you would have moved me, did, as I sat lone and wanting, in nocturnal cafes where sugar rushed my hungry pages, below stars that could explain you no better than else, in dreams where your auburn hair would come undone, and I would lose within your body what my last hour will never know in your heart.
And you're doing them shorter, too.
Yeah. For better work. And this last one, I was thinking to myself, I was thinking about power and about the idea of conferring power upon people and the idea of power people have over each other. And so I wrote a lesson in power. In the taking of a kingdom or a heart, a beast for its meat or seed for its fruit, there's a push, a breath, an acquiesce, one world coming, another one gone, a feed in victory by stars and firelight. In release again there is loss, for how her body tasted that mountainside afternoon, for how thousands once bowed to a flag, its ideas triumphant by gunpoint, a silence, a burial in breath. Derive this lesson then. Neither the take nor the release will last, and whatever drinks of power's thunder tonight will crest again fallow another. What carries the years neither king nor kingdom? What carries not the singer nor the song?
And this is a letter from William Burroughs to Allen Ginsberg. And unfortunately, you don't get the reply from most of these letters. I mean, Allen Ginsberg must have got the letters because here they are published. Because in the very back, there's like two letters from Allen Ginsberg when he goes back to Peru and, you know, goes, oh, yeah, yeah.
How about
this
that?
Is whacked. But you can see the different sort of portraits. He's, you know, the profiles of the persons. Of course, you know, it's separated by about 7 years, too. And Ginsberg, he was kind of a friendly gay old fuck, whereas Burroughs was kind of like this jaded, weird kind of old gay fuck.
Who nonetheless would put himself out there in the world.
Oh, strange my God. Ways. And you read this book, he's like, he's constantly being rolled and sleeping with boys. And, you know, it's like you go, that's one thing I come away reading this book on. Well, you know, now I think you would actually call Burroughs a pedophile. You know, it's always paying some boy in Peru $30 to give him a hand job or something. You know, wow. But, so he writes all these letters to Allen Ginsberg. And this is circa 1953. This is actually a book that I kind of wish I would have read way back when I first started to, you know, this quest for psychedelics and this kind of thing. It's kind of funny that this book is this old. It's about ayahuasca.
Yeah.
And here it's been rolling around for 50 years.
He was trying to kick junk, heroin or something. I mean, that's why he went down there. Burroughs went down there on a mission.
I think he was looking for a new high.
But he's also trying to kick heroin.
But he was kind of, because it sounds like he was kind of, he might have accidentally kicked junk while he was down there because he couldn't find anything.
Oh, well,
he couldn't score much shit while he was down there because he bitches about it through the whole book.
Okay.
He's like, but some of the situations that he puts himself into, they sound surreal. And I guess actually in the latter part of this book is where he started to really develop his surrealistic writing style. But
because of his experiences down there?
Yeah, because of his
well, Latin American writers always describe, I mean, if you read like Borges and, you know, South American writers, Latin American writers.
So here he writes, this is, again, this is about like 1953, and he's in Peru at this point. I bookmarked this one because it was kind of funny. You know, he's kind of funny. He's kind of like, you never really know which way to take this guy. He writes dark. You know, but again, he kind of writes angry, and so that makes it kind of funny, right?
And if you've ever heard him read, he has that raspy voice.
Oh, fuck, yeah, he rolls on in that monotone like that science teacher that you hated.
Yeah.
Because I read some of this stuff aloud, trying to kind of get that William Burroughs cadence. Oh, where are you? Yeah, because that's what he sounds like. He sounds like this car that won't start. Right? So, let's see. July 8, 1930, Jose Leal, Lima. Dear Alan, back in Lima after a 3-day bus ride. Last 5 days in Pucallpa, I was waiting to leave, but trapped by rain and impassable roads and the plane booked solid. The naval lieutenant did a hideous strip tease with his character armor. Everybody yelling, "For God's sake, keep it on!" He began goosing the waiter, and when I passed his room in the morning, he would rush to the door and show me a hard-on and say, "Hello, Bill!" Even the other Peruvians were embarrassed. The furniture salesman wanted to go into the cocaine business and get rich and live in Lima and drive a fishtail Cadillac. Oh, God. People think all they have to do is go into shady business and they will get rich overnight. They don't realize that business, shady or legitimate, is the same fucking headache. And the old German went on and on about the treasure. They were driving me crazy with their silly talk and their stupid Spanish jokes. I felt like Ruth amidst the alien corn. When they said that American literature did not exist and English literature was very poor, I lost my temperature and told them that Spanish literature belonged in the outhouse on a peg with an old Montgomery Ward catalog. Oh, I was shaking with rage and realized how the place was dragging me. Huh. Met a young Dane and took Yahi with him. Yahi's ayahuasca.
Right.
I met a young Dane and took Yahi with him. He immediately vomited it up and avoided me after that. He evidently thought I tried to poison him, and he was saved only by the prompt reaction of his hygienic Scandinavian gut.
Oh.
I never knew a Dane that wasn't bone dull. Terrible bus trip back to Tingo Maria, where I got drunk and was helped to bed by the cutest assistant truck driver. Hung up 2 days in Huanaco, an awful dump. Spent my time wandering around, taking pictures, trying to get the bare, dry mountains, the wind and the dusty poplar trees, the little parks with statues of generals and cupids, and Indians lolling around with a special South American abandon chewing coca. The government sells it in controlled shops, and doing absolutely nothing. At 5 o'clock, had a few drinks at a Chinese restaurant where the owner picked his teeth and went over his books. How sane they are and how little they expect from life. He looked like junk to me, but you can never be sure with the Chinese. They're all basically junkies in outlook. A lunatic came into the bar and went into a long, incomprehensible routine. He had the figure $17 million written on the back of his shirt and turned around to show it to me.
Huh.
Then he went over and harangued the owner. The owner sat there picking his teeth. He showed neither contempt nor amusement nor sympathy. He just sat there picking a molar and occasionally taking the toothpick out and looking at the end of it. Passed through some of the highest towns in the world. They have a curious exotic Mongolian or Tibetan look, horribly cold. 3 times, all the foreigners were asked to get out of the bus and register with the police.
Hmm.
Passport number, age, and profession. All this pure formality. No trace of suspicion or interrogation. What do they do with these records? Use them for toilet paper, I expect. Lima, cold, damp, and depressing. Went to Mercado. None of the boys around anymore. Bum kicked to go into a bar I used to like. Nobody there I know or want to know. The bar has been moved for no organic reason from one side of the joint to the other.
Hmm.
Different waiters. Nothing I want to hear on the jukebox. Am I in the right bar? Everybody has gone, and I am alone in a nowhere place. Every night the people will be uglier and stupider, the fixtures more hideous, the waiters ruder, the music more grating, on and on like a speed-up movie in a nightmare vortex of mechanical disintegration and meaningless change.
Holy cow.
I did see one boy in the Mercado I knew before I left Lima. He looked years older. I had been away for 6 weeks. When I first saw him, he wouldn't drink, saying with a shy smile, "I am still a boy." Now he was drunk, scar under left eye. I touched it and said, "Knife?" He said, "Yes," and smiled, his eyes glazed and bloodshot. Suddenly I wanted to leave Lima right away. This feeling of urgency has followed me like my ass all over South America. I had to be somewhere at a certain time. In Guadalcanal, I dragged a Peruvian consul out of his house after hours so I could get a visa and leave a day earlier. Where am I going in such a hurry? Appointment in Talara, Tingo Maria, Pucallpa, Panama, Guatemala, Mexico City? I don't know. Suddenly I have to leave right now. Love, Bill.